Okay, let's go ahead and begin. Good afternoon, everyone. This is a public rulemaking hearing held pursuant to the State Administrative Procedure Act, Section 244.103, Colorado Revised Statutes. The date is Tuesday, November 10th, 2009. The time is about 2:03 p.m. We're meeting in the Secretary of State's Blue Spruce Conference Room, 1700 Broadway, Denver, Colorado. My name is Bill Hobbs. I'm Deputy Secretary of State, and I'll be conducting the hearing on behalf of Secretary of State Bernie Buescher. Some other introductions at the table. To my immediate left is Judd Choate, Director of Elections for the Secretary of State. To my far left is Monica Marquez, Deputy Attorney General, and Matt Grove, Assistant Attorney General, who represent the Secretary of State's office. To my immediate right is Hillary Rudy, and then Andrea Geiger, a legal specialist with the Elections Division of the Colorado Secretary of State. The purpose of the hearing today is to receive comments from the public on proposed rules that are amendments to the Secretary of State's election rules. There was a notice of rulemaking issued on September 30th, which was published in the Colorado Register on October 10th. The draft rules were subsequently amended, and the statement of basis and purpose was subsequently amended on November 2nd, 2009. And those are the versions that we're working from today. They were also posted on our website. So just to be clear, I hope everybody's working from the November 2nd draft of the proposed amendments to the rules. Copies are on the table by the door. Also, there are sign-up sheets on the table by the door for anybody who wishes to testify. When you testify, please be sure to identify for the record not only your name, but who you represent, if anyone. We are broadcasting over the Internet. This is a public rulemaking hearing, so it's recorded. I anticipate I'll leave the record open for, I'm not sure yet, till Tuesday?
Thursday.
Through the close of business on Thursday, in order to receive additional written comments. And I especially encourage that. I know sometimes during the course of the public hearing, comments are made that generates additional feedback. And so I certainly encourage anyone present or anyone who's listening to take advantage of that and provide additional written comments to us by the close of business on Thursday. I would like to spend a few minutes going through the major purposes of the amendments before I turn it over to public comment. The proposed statement of basis and purpose does provide a fair amount of detail of the purpose of the changes, but I would like to summarize that. As is typical with a lot of the rulemaking that we do in the elections area, a lot of the proposed rules are intended to deal with questions that have arisen. There seems to be no end to questions, so we're always trying to answer questions, and frequently rulemaking is a good way to do that. Also, we have new legislation to implement, and so some of the proposed rules deal with changes to the election rules to implement the new legislation. Just to summarize in a few minutes what some of the major changes are, there are amendments to Rules 2.18 and 2.20 that deal with the National Change of Address database, and we're trying to answer some questions about how that database is used. What happens when the NCOA database indicates that an elector may have moved out of the county? On the one hand, what has to be done in that situation? And then on the other hand, what happens when the NCOA database indicates that an elector may have moved within the same county? And a key point there is that in that case, the elector will not have their voter registration canceled, but at least based on information from the National Change of Address database. New Rule 2.21 deals with minimum matching criteria. There we're trying to answer some questions and clarify The rules for purposes of resolving discrepancies in the name or the suffix and the address for purpose of determining when two records in fact do match. There is a proposed new rule 2.22. That rule is establishing a deadline for processing duplicate records and requires that the duplicate processing would end 90 days before a federal election, but that would not take effect until 2012 because, as many of you know, we are currently trying to consolidate a great many duplicate records that are primarily the result of migrating older data into the new, relatively new, statewide voter registration database, the SCORE system. So a lot of duplicate records were migrated into that, and we are hoping well prior to 2012 to have as many of those as possible where there are duplicates merged into a single record. There is a proposed new rule 2.23 that would require counties to mail a notification letter to any elector whose record is consolidated or canceled within 90 days prior to a federal election. And the new rule is also intended to provide that if any record is consolidated or canceled based on erroneous information, the elector would have an opportunity to reinstate prior to election day. There are revisions to Rule 12 that deal with mail ballot elections, primarily dealing with the implementation of House Bill 1015 that concerns primary elections conducted by mail ballot. And we're also trying to answer some questions that have arisen regarding mail ballot plans under the mail ballot law. There are a number of revisions proposed for Rule 26 that deal with provisional voting. Generally, we're trying to, again, to clarify the process for verifying provisional ballots and answer some questions that arose during the 2008 general election. Also trying to clarify the treatment of the provisional ballot envelope and affidavit does serve as an application for registration for future elections. There are some revisions to Rule 30 that deal with voter identification. In particular, we're proposing to clarify that a valid tribal identification card does fall under the definition of a government document, and therefore it's an acceptable form of identification under the election code. And an underlying purpose there is to provide some clarification for election workers and to encourage voter participation by easing the burden on electors who may have no other form of identification. There is a proposed new rule 30.11.3, which is intended to implement House Bill 1336, which concerns identification requirements for voting in person by residents of a group residential facility. And we're also proposing to establish some county procedures and clarifications regarding the documentation that is sufficient to verify whether an elector does in fact reside at a group residential facility. There are some revisions to Rule 44, which concerns voter registration drives. We are there trying to clarify the renewal and training requirements and trying to establish the same procedures for the initial VRD registration and the renewal registration, as well as provide for online training for all voter registration drive organizers. We have a proposed new Rule 51 dealing with election forms. We're trying to, in general, there promote uniformity in the administration of the election laws and provide for consistent forms. We're also trying to clarify that while political parties and other organizations can provide election forms to the public, and that they may use the national mail voter registration, we're trying to encourage the use of the state form because of some additional protections that have been built into the state form. So with that background, I would like to turn to public comment, and I'll turn to the sign-up sheet. I think the first person signed up who wishes to testify is Richard Westfall. Mr. Westfall, you would like to come forward? Identify yourself for the record and who you represent. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. My name is Richard Westfall. I'm a lawyer with the law firm of Hale Friesen, and I'm appearing here today in my role as co-chairman of the Colorado Lawyers Committee Elections Task Force. We actually have a couple of members of our task force here, Jenny Flanagan and Faith Gross. Also, the person who was supposed to appear with me, there were two people that were also supposed to appear with me today. One, Martha Tierney, who's my co-chair of the Elections Task Force, who just sent me an email, she has a filing deadline today in the Court of Appeals, and I'm afraid that's preventing her from being here right now, so I apologize on her behalf. And I also apologize on behalf of Jennifer Weddle, who is the head, and she was the one that was going to be providing the primary testimony on behalf of our task force today. And the specific rule that I was going to speak to is the tribal ID issue. And I believe that is on page 23 of 34, and that is the rule 30.1.6 that you, Mr. Hobbs, had referred to in your general overview that you were providing of the rules. And the specific reason for adoption of those rules, first of all, I would like to wholeheartedly say that we completely agree and endorse this amendment to the rule. And Ms. Weddle was, again, planning on giving the substance of our testimony and providing the level of detail to create more of an administrative record, and hopefully she'll be able to do that. She unfortunately informed us last night she has a serious medical emergency that is preventing her from being here today, and I apologize. We were planning on providing more substantive comments than what I will be able to provide you in support of that particular rule, and again, hopefully Jennifer will be in a position where she'll be able to provide written comment by this Thursday. I don't know if she'll be able to do so or not. Hopefully, it will not be an issue. But we did want to. We do want to support this particular rule. We want to say we strongly are in favor of recognizing tribal identifications. It's my understanding, based upon my somewhat limited knowledge in this area, that both the Southern Ute Tribe and the Ute Mountain Ute Tribe really do believe that this is an appropriate addition to the rulemaking to allow tribal identifications. It's my understanding that there has been no hint whatsoever from local officials, election officials that are in the La Plata County Four Corners area where the Ute Mountain Ute Tribe and Southern Ute Tribe reside, that there's any problem whatsoever with respect to tribal identifications. And there is a one other thing, and I apologize for not having the level of specificity because I was planning on Jennifer being able to make these comments. It's understanding that there's also there are significant numbers of Navajos that reside statewide, not just in the Four Corner area, and that again, there's no. It's certainly my understanding that there's no issue there with respect to validly issued Navajo tribal identifications, and so. We believe this is a positive change to the rules. We believe this is something that we've been wanting to see changed in the regulations for a while regarding identification, and we fully support that particular change of the rules.
Okay, thank you. In order to make sure that the Secretary of State understands all testimony, I do like to provide an opportunity for other people that are here at the table with me to see if they have any questions. So that's what I will typically do when someone provides testimony. So are there any questions for Mr. Westfall? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Westfall. Appreciate it.
Thank you, and thank you for not asking me a tough question. I can provide the answer to.
Russ Ragsdale.
Good afternoon. I'm Russ Ragsdale, the City and County Clerk from Broomfield. I'm here to present this hearing with written comments from the Colorado County Clerks Association. I believe we did submit those yesterday. I'm not sure how the board would prefer we progress on that, whether you want to cover those individually. But before we do that, I do have a couple of general comments, if I could, if you would indulge me. In going through these rules, it struck me, we have 450 pages of Title I laws. We have 180 pages of current promulgated rules governing elections in Colorado. We have the U.S. Constitution. We have HAVA. We have UOCAVA, the National Voter Registration Act. We have the Colorado State Constitution. We have conditions of use for our voting systems. We have Title 31 in case of municipal elections. And in a lot of cases, we have charters, individual municipal charters to deal with. One may draw the conclusion that with all of that guidance, a county clerk cannot possibly make a mistake in operating an election. Unfortunately, it works quite the opposite. And I would just, Mr. Hobbs, back to your comments before and the purpose of this, and I appreciate that we're trying to clarify statute and new statutes. At some point, this becomes quite overbearing. And I've said on many occasions, the worst thing an election administrator can have in Colorado is a memory. Because of the rapidity of changes that come at us. This is the fourth, if I'm correct, the fourth rulemaking session we've had this year, in addition to the emergency rulemaking session in January of this year, in addition to the General Assembly session of this year that also presented a load of election changes for us. It's me whining. It's quite simply. It's what it is. I'll stop. I hope you get my point. And as you sit down and start pondering the next set of rule changes, please keep my whining in mind, will you? Thank you. The second general comment is one about timing. And you won't find that in the comments and questions that were submitted by the clerks, but it was a very common comment I heard from the clerks that the timing was unfortunate this go around. The notice of rulemaking went out at the end of September. With the November 3rd election that we were all conducting, we did find it difficult in getting the time to review these in depth and getting our staff also having the opportunity to read through these. So I appreciate you extending the deadline for written comments. I would imagine there will be several counties that take advantage of that. Back to my first question, how would you like to proceed on this? We have a fairly lengthy list of comments and questions. I'm prepared to go point by point, but...
Well, I do appreciate that. You do have written comments. They're pretty detailed, it looks like. I haven't had a chance personally to go through them, and I wish I had, because then I could focus just on questions. So I'm not sure how to provide guidance necessarily. I definitely want to provide an opportunity for you to hit any of the major points that you feel that are important. I don't know that it's necessary to just repeat what you've already provided.
Okay. So, what we try to do in the submitted comments is separate the questions from the comments. And I think what you will see is there are a lot of questions that came from the county clerks. We just, quite honestly, didn't understand the intent or the purpose or the result of the proposed rule. And we're very curious. You touched upon the NCOA processing. That's a new process to most county clerks. We're all curious on how that's going to work, what that looks like. Unfortunately, we didn't have a chance to meet with Secretary of State staff to discuss the mechanics of these proposed rules, so we're all a little bit in the dark of what the consequences are going to be. Speaking of the NCOA, that was one of the first ones. If you'd like, I'll just start on Rule 2.18.2. We let you slide on 2.18.1, but then we got started. A lot of questions, a lot of concerns with the creation of additional subcategories of inactive voters. It may be very meaningful what those subcategories are, but I think there needs to be some education to the clerks of what those categories are. what their eventual purpose is and how they're going to be used within the cancellation process and further mail-in ballot requirements. But I think there's really a need for education among the county clerks on what this NCOA process, how it's envisioned by the Secretary's office. There was some comments concerning that being an unfunded mandate. Again, I would ask the Secretary's staff to consider this point when developing any new rules. Is it an additional overhead to the counties? In these days of crushing budget constraints, we have to keep that on the table. We have to keep that to the forefront. Any new additional mailings, any new additional functions that are required of county clerk staff have a cost, have a price to them. Let's see what some important points in this one. One of the things that was brought up that I thought personally was interesting was that there was a comment that the proposed rule 2.18.2 suggests that the Secretary of State will, through SCORE, generate a list and forward that list to the clerk for validation. We're very curious, and maybe you can respond to this, is that envisioned as an automated process, or is that actually generating a hard copy list or even a soft copy list for individual record processing and eyes-on processing to be done by the clerk, or can that be done and should that be done in a more automated fashion? Again, considering the overhead, the cost of the counties, and plus the accuracy. When you involve that, the staff having to review every single record, you also introduce human error. Is there an answer to that by chance that you could provide? Was that considered as an automated process? Or
that's something that we just need to work through and try to clarify?
Yeah, I think so. I think we don't really have an answer to that yet, but we're kind of seeking your input on what that process might look like from your perspective.
Okay.
All right. Point taken.
I also have, if I may, I don't know if you allow gang testimony. Is that feasible?
Gang testimony?
I am a co-chair of the Election Statute Review Committee, and my co-chair, my colleague Teague Simonson from Eagle County, is here, and Mike Scarpello is also on that commission. I just want to make sure that I'm hitting what everyone considers the major points. We did this in between election processes.
Sure.
And I
appreciate, I really, first of all, appreciate the time you were able to take in looking at these rules, as well as the time you've been able to put together, it took to put together the comments that you have. I understand it's not necessarily a completely polished presentation, and if it's helpful for them to come forward and just, or at least to be nearby to chime in, that would be great. All they'd need to do is come forward and one time identify themselves for the record, and then you can gang testify.
All right.
Okay.
Complete and polished. I like that. Yeah. You're right. I missed the mark on that. So I would, if you guys wouldn't mind, I know what some of these I feel are important. Again, it's nice to hear from the other clerks. We have the Election Statute Review Commission, or committee, I think we have, but we can't have more than 64 members, but it's all of our counties, but we are very close to that, it seems like. We have a good-sized committee, so we do have the opportunity to get a lot of feedback. But on this, I would ask you guys, you want to identify yourself?
Yes, Teague Simonton, Eagle County Clerk and Recorder.
Thanks, Teague.
Michael Scarpello, Director of Elections for the City and County of Denver.
Okay, thank you, Mike.
I would like to chime in on the one that Russ just mentioned, 2.18.2. I certainly understand the intent of that rule regarding putting those addresses, people who we get a hit on NCOA, into a system so that we can send them correspondence. But I just want to reiterate the point that Russ made. To do it as it's spelled out in this rule, in other words, to where it says they'll put the addresses into the SCORE forwarding address, if that is not an automated process, that is an incredible burden. I'll just give you some example. In Denver this year, we had over 30,000 of those hits that we would have to manually put into score. So it seems rather premature to put this into rule that we actually use the word score. I mean, if it's score or some other system or some other method that we could get that correspondence to people, that would be very helpful. Because in fact, that is the way we do it now. We do it outside of score because score doesn't have those capabilities.
Now, I'm sorry, elaborate just a little bit on how you're doing it now. This is with the NCOA database, okay.
Right.
Well, go ahead.
So when we run an NCOA, we get hits back from the post office, our vendor, telling us who is you know, what their forwarding address is, and we put that into a Microsoft Access database and then generate our letters from that database. We don't put that directly into score.
Okay.
One of the comments that came in was that I particularly enjoyed was maintenance of the voter status is an internal administrative process that the voter cannot be expected to understand, that we ourselves only somewhat understand. Telling the voter that they must respond in order to the mailing in order to update their status to activate their status invites confusion. I think there's a bigger point there. And one of the things I'll share an experience with this year, this past election, and I don't know what the solution is to this, but it's a problem that we need to keep on at the forefront when we're talking about new rules and new laws. A lot of voters asked me this year, in conducting a mail-in ballot, who did you mail ballots to? Well, it's one thing to be able to say, we mailed to all active voters. Most voters get a hold of that, and they can understand the difference between active and inactive. Well, now we have two categories of inactive, and inactive failed to vote. So there was an additional level of complexity that had to be explained to the voters. What this rule does is now create additional subcategories of the inactive. And I think we have to keep in mind, are we doing a service to the voters? Because we're going to be asked to explain that to them and not necessarily in a four-hour training session of our voters. This is going to be over a phone call, and it's something that it becomes more difficult to explain to the voter and educate to them what we're doing to their record. So if we would just keep that in mind as we do this. I was driving down here today, and I was following a car that had a license plate on it, SMPLIFY. And that was either Samplify or Simplify. I'm thinking it was Simplify, and I thought I should have pulled it off his car and brought it with.
I had one other additional comment in addition to that. Another thing to keep in mind about the use of NCOA for the in-county, out-of-county designations, NCOAs do not accurately, in all cases, mark someone as in a particular county. In other words, for instance, in Denver, we have addresses, you know, someone might be, according to the post office, they're called Denver, but they might be in Arapahoe County. They might be in Jefferson County. So it's not even as easy as an automated process. Many times we have to go in by hand and look at these things one by one, but in order to do that, it requires a lot of time and effort and money. So it's something to keep in mind as we write these rules.
Mr. Hobbs, you made a statement that you're hoping for some input from us, and Ms. Rudy, you said the same thing. How do you envision this becoming reality? How do we implement this program after the rules have been adopted, assuming these rules are going to be adopted as is? Where will that – and what I'm referring to is some of the questions that came from the clerks, because I would hope that when we do work sessions and begin to implement the program to support these rules – that will flesh these details out. Specifically, here's a question. If the voter moved to another county, does the voter receive instructions to return the card to the new county? This rule reads as if the card will be returned to the old county, which makes no sense. It's a detail and process that has to be worked out. How do you envision that process being worked out?
Do you want to comment?
Sure. I think that, you know, the first step really is to figure out the rules, and once we've addressed what we think the right rules are based upon the testimony that we receive, then I think the next step is then to set out the processes for implementing the NCOA check, working with the counties, and then we address those specific issues about whether or not the voter needs to return that card to the previous county or to the new county, how we make sure that that notice is properly worded in order to encourage the voter to do that.
Okay, so you envision that as in some sort of work sessions, meetings with clerks and with the SCORE advisory committee and what have you. Is that correct? Am I assuming that?
I think that's right, and I think, again, to the extent that we can identify some of these areas of confusion or conflict or ambiguity, then it'd be best to try to fix the rule right now. Mm-hmm. To the extent that there's details to be figured out, then, you know, I think we're going to be continuing to work with people, for example, at the clerk's conference and so forth. I think this will be an ongoing effort. I don't think we're picturing doing this until June, is that? When would this be?
June of 2011.
Yeah. Okay. So we have a year and a half to work
this
out.
That's an interesting piece of information.
Okay.
June of 2011. I think a lot of us were thinking, yeah, is that specifically for this rule of the NCOA processing, or is that as a whole? Just the NCOA processing.
The NCOA processing, right. The rule does say that it's June 1 of the odd-numbered year following a general election. So what we're looking at is the inactive failed-to-vote voters from the previous general election.
I think the question then would that answer begs the question. If a county, like I know several counties do, use NCOA process to keep their voter list clean, would that fall outside of these rules? The handling of those people that we get hits on.
I don't know. That's a good question. I suspect to the extent that you're doing it in advance of a requirement that you would still be subject to the rule. So that I think everyone should be following the same procedures as to, you know, when are voters canceled, when are they not, what notices are they given. I think we probably would want to encourage uniformity across the state in that area. But that's something we need to look at in drafting the rule.
Well, I would suggest that then if that were the case, then I think that we really need to collectively get together and talk about proper list maintenance using NCOA, not only for these inactive field of votes, but for the whole list as a whole. Because we're wasting a lot of money in postage. And if we use NCOA properly, we can save an awful lot of money.
Okay.
I'd also like to make another comment to that regard, too. I would love to see the Secretary of State's office do a serious consideration and a serious analysis of the benefit of central printing and postage and mailing services. We did make an informal run at that, if I may, earlier this year, and I'd like to see that promoted. I think there may be some real benefits there, some economies of scale. I'm not suggesting that the Secretary of State bear all the costs of printing and postage, but I think maybe if we centralize it and figure out some way of reimbursement to the state, it may benefit us all. Okay, shall we move on? Got a comment on 2.18.3 that I think is reflective of the general sense or the general feelings of a lot of clerks. The question is first of all, there's a question, what about duplicates? And 2.18.3 has to do with the canceling of voter records. The question is, what about duplicates? If we know there's a duplicate record, can we merge without canceling? 2.18.3 prohibits canceling. And then it says it shall cancel only the registrations of electors who have met the following requirements. If we have a record or multiple records that fall outside of these categories, does it still allow merging? Probably one of those questions that have been better skipping, Hillary.
Okay. Well,
I think 2.18.3 18.3 really deals with the process under Section 12605, Paragraph 7, which is the cancellation of voters who have failed to respond to a mailing and have been inactive for two federal elections under the NVRA. So I don't think that this rule is intended to preclude other list maintenance cancellations. I think it's intended to say who the scope of those cancellations are following a general election under the NVRA.
So the answer to that would emerge, considering the other rules, if it's valid.
I think so.
And then the comment was, if we're not going to cancel inactive failed to votes, and we're going to mail them ballots for mail ballot elections, why not just leave them as active failed to vote? Send them one continuation mailing if they fail to vote, but stop switching their status back and forth if they don't respond. If their continuation card comes back undeliverable, then make them inactive undeliverable or inactive NCOA. I don't want to get into the details of this comment because, again, the subcategories and how they interplay. But it was very representative of a lot of the comments we received. There was some frustration over additional subcategories and confusion on how those subcategories were going to be managed. Absolutely.
I think that was my comment. One of the things that occurs to me is there are a lot of people out there who just don't vote, but they want to remain active on the voter rolls, and they certainly don't want to be canceled. They may decide that something is really moving, and they want to come and vote some year, and they're very surprised in most cases when we have to reinstate a canceled registration that they were canceled just because they didn't vote. So I know it's legislative and not necessarily rules, but I think that's something that should be looked at. Why are we putting someone on the cancellation cycle simply because they failed to vote? If they're no longer around, we're going to determine that pretty easily through one of the mailings that we send that comes back undeliverable. It would simplify things also for purposes of calculating turnout and for, you know, telling people in a mail ballot election year who we're mailing to, active voters.
And Hillary can probably respond better, but, you know, we're not canceling anyone. It's just a question of who is active and who is inactive, and the primary consequence is who is automatically mailed a ballot in a mail ballot election.
Right, but inactive failed to vote is mailed a ballot in a mail ballot election now.
Okay.
I think in 2009 coordinated election and in future mail ballot primaries, inactive failed to vote voters would be mailed a ballot. I think this is probably something that we want to return to and revisit after we look at the turnout and the results of how many of those voters returned a ballot, how many of those ballots were undeliverable in the 2009 coordinated election. But in terms of inactive failed to vote voters, the statutes did set up that new subcategory, and those individuals are not subject to the cancellation following a general election for inactivity over the two federal election period. So we would not cancel those voters. They'd stay there, potentially inactive failed to vote, unless we had some indication that they had moved.
Yeah, see, again, I think it just creates confusion. Why not keep them active and failed to vote? But that's another discussion. So,
I believe Teak and I were called upon by the CCCA to represent him today because we best represent the idea of confusion. Rule 2.19.1, the confirmation card that is mailed by forwardable mail. One comment I got back, and I think this is something I really, again, like to point out, the mailing shall be postage prepaid and have a returnable portion that is pre-addressed to the sending county clerk and recorder. Understand the need for that. A lot of counties send that out, business reply, so that everything that comes back is expensive. We pay the postage and pay a very premium cost for that postage. We'd like to see that all correspondence that goes out have a message on it that encourages voters to use the online registration process when it becomes available, and use that when a voter chooses to do an online in lieu of returning the document. Again, with the idea of lowering costs. Any others in here you're going to jump on?
Curious about that.
2.21. Before we move off 2.19, under 2.19.2, the new rule is, in accordance with Section 11-109-1 CRS, the Secretary of State shall consider best practices and usability in the design of the confirmation card in order to minimize voter confusion. I got at least three comments about the use of the word consider. We were curious what that meant. Consider like a fairly soft.
Is there a better? How would you make it harder?
Shall.
And how would you enforce that?
I don't know. It's just that consider, it's like, does that belong in rules? I guess that was a good question. Consider, that's just a practice. It's not really enforceable by rule, so why is it in the rules? Or start using the word consider in all of our rules. That's a great, that's an alternative. Yeah, there we go. We considered it, Bill, seriously. Mike, what was the next one you wanted to?
I don't want to skip ahead. 2.21.1. I was curious about the permissive language in that. It says, if the minimum matching criteria are not met, the county may send a letter to the voter requesting confirmation of the missing non-matching information in order to transfer, consolidate, or cancel the record. I was curious as to why that was permissive language rather than mandatory, in that that seems like that could have some issues between the counties and some legal protection. Maybe there's a great answer. I don't know.
I don't know that there is. I mean, if there's not a match, I guess, the thought was, do you really have to send a notice at all, or do you think that this should be changed to shall?
Not sure.
Okay.
I think we need to take a harder look at it.
Okay.
We could jump ahead to 2.22, and again, this is more comments, more questions on list maintenance, and I think Mr. Scarpello had a good idea. I think we'd really love to have the opportunity to sit down with the Secretary and staff and discuss in total list maintenance, how we go about doing it. 2.22, one of the questions, the county has canceled its primary election now. That's allowed by statute if there are no contested races. Can that county continue to cancel or merge records up to within 90 days of the general election? And there was a comment asking, what authority is the SOS calling upon, the Secretary of State calling upon, to cease consolidation or canceling duplicate records prior to a non-federal election such as the primary? And you have clarified that, I believe, in the revised November 2nd revised draft. I believe you changed the rule to include primary or general election rather than federal. Brings primary in. But there was a lot of concern about list maintenance, about proper records being in there. When we see that there is a duplicate record, if we're not allowed to do merging at that distance from an election, it will create duplicate records in our and possibly lead to mailing out duplicate ballots. That's not an outcome many clerks want to entertain. So we need to take a hard look at that. 2.23, lots of comments on this new proposed rule. County clerk and recorder shall mail a letter to any electors whose records are consolidated or whose duplicate record is canceled in accordance with Section 12604 CRS within the period beginning 90 days prior to a primary or general election. The letter shall be sent to the address of the record canceled or consolidated. It shall advise the elector of the consolidation or cancellation. It shall inform the elector how he or she may correct any errors. One of the questions, why should clerks be required to send a letter to a consolidated voter as they are remaining on the rolls and not canceled? I assume the answer to that is in the event of an error. We are merging two different voters. Is that a correct assumption?
I think that's right.
That's correct.
A lot of comments on that. that because of the matching criteria and the effort we put into that, that that is going to be a very, very small percentage of the cases, and yet we're required to send correspondence. Again, a cost, an additional burden to the counties, to all voters where we merge records. I'm not sure we're getting a good return on our investment there.
Okay.
Absolutely.
You know, and as I'm thinking that through, it would seem to be a much better solution. I don't have the specific terms of the solution in my mind yet, but if we could come up with a reasonable remedy for those people who happen to be merged when they shouldn't have been on election day, to make it easy for them to be reinstated, for those very few people who might be in that situation, rather than at this point they have to come to the county clerk's office and prove that they've been around for 6 years, maybe there's a way to go at it from the other end to make it easier to rectify the situation should it be determined that there has been an error.
And, you know, there is the provisional ballot process, but are you thinking that there should be some other remedy?
Yeah.
That's easier?
Because if we've made a mistake, putting a voter through the provisional ballot process, frankly, is a hassle.
But what would that – tell me what that would look like.
You know, I just said I'm not sure, but let me think about that. Because, okay. You know, right off the top of my head, it's perhaps presenting ID to the poll worker, the judge, and a call to the clerk or the deputy clerk and a review of the record. And most often when someone calls from a polling place and there is an error in a registration, it's very easily determined. Oh, yes, we can see what happened here. We didn't change the date back to October 6th or whatever it happens to be. And we have very high-level people looking into those records on election day, and we issue self-affirmations for people to be able to vote at the polling place. But I think it would be easy for a high-level clerk's official or deputy to determine that and give the authority over the phone to the worker at the polls so that that voter would be able to vote easier. Something like that. I'll think about it, though.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes. 2.22 and 2.23, and forgive me, this has been a few weeks ago and we've had an election since, and trying to spark my memory on what exactly, but let me just read the comment that we had put down and maybe this will help bring it up. 2.22, this is confusing at best since 2.22 forbids the consolidation or cancellation of duplicate records within 90 days prior to a primary or general. And then 2.23 requires a mailing to consolidated or canceled voters who were canceled within 90 days of federal election. If it is meant to vary the wording from Rule 2.22 to allow cancellation or consolidation within the 90-day period, it is confusing as to when it would be allowed. Mailing of the letters is already required for any record that does not fit the minimum matching criteria. When a record is consolidated, or one of the duplicate records is canceled, there remains a registered record for the person. If this rule means to require a letter to every canceled consolidated elector, the information we provide in the letter may confuse the issue by making them believe they are no longer registered.
Okay, thank you. We'll look at that.
One question on 12.3.4. Are you ready to move on? You're probably more than ready.
I'm sorry, which rule?
12.3.4.
Okay.
Paragraph B, we do have a question. It requires public comment, the clerk to seek public comment. The question is how to be submitted in writing. Is that public comment required to be in writing, or can a public meeting with verbal comments suffice? The proposed rule says, and this is about making a determination to whether to conduct a primary election as a mail ballot election. The county clerk and recorder shall seek public comment on the determination to conduct a primary election as a mail ballot election for a period of not less than 10 days. Can that be done in a series of town hall meetings, for example, rather than, or does it have to be in writing? the public input.
What would you prefer, first of all? And then,
the latitude to do either.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. Mail ballot plans. This drew a lot of questions and comments, some concern about the time frames. This is an interesting one. Following proposed rule 12.4.1 is a statement that reads, note, this rule relocated from rule 12.3.2 to consolidate rules regarding mail ballot plans and reworded for clarity. However, upon further inspection, it appears that there may be substantive changes that are not readily apparent when the section was relocated to 12.4.1. The existing rule 12.3.2 paragraph D, which rule 12.4.1 paragraph D seeks to replace, states in D, citation of the statute or home rule charter provisions authorizing the election. The proposed rule provides, quote, citation of the statute authorizing the election. Thus, the phrase, or home rule charter provisions, was deleted. The question, why was this provision deleted? And the Secretary's office should consider whether the note provided immediately following 12.4.1 provides the reader with proper notice to a potentially substantive change in rules. And I'm particularly sensitive to that, being in a city and county, as I'm sure my colleague, Mr. Scarpillo, was sensitive. Not the author of that comment, but it was a good catch. So we moved the rule, but we also changed it, dropped the phrase that could substantially have changed the outcome of that rule. So the question is, why was that phrase or home rule charter provisions needed?
And Russ, where is that phrase in the existing rule?
The existing rule is 12.3.2D.
So D was dropped?
Or moved.
Okay. I don't know. It may have been inadvertent, but we can take a look at that. I'm not aware of a reason for dropping it.
If there was a specific reason, okay. Michael and I are sensitive about our home rule charters, I think. And then there was a comment, too, if this rule applies to recall elections, as it appears to do, if an entity calls for a recall election in 45 days, which is allowable under law, the deadline for submitting a mail ballot plan required in this proposed rule of 55 days is unachievable. So if we do a recall election and we want to do it by mail, entities can call a recall election 45 days out. And this rule requires the mail ballot plan to be submitted by 55 days prior to the election. So we need to, it appears we need to reconcile that.
Okay.
On this 12.4.1.1, it's just a simple clerical correction site.
Page 10, line, where are you?
Page 11, top of the page.
Okay.
It says this rule relocated from 12.3.2.1.
And what should that be, Mike?
The note following the rule states that this provision was relocated. Actually, I probably gave you the wrong page. Let me just read. The note following proposed rule 12.4.1.1 states that this provision was relocated from rule 12.2.1. However, 12.2.1 addresses election judges, and the language stated is not related to this section. The correct reference in the note should be 12.3. I think you guys corrected it already.
Maybe
now
so.
Now that I'm looking at it,
and
the revised, it is correct.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, I think we had it wrong.
Read your mind. You want to do?
I have a question, Hillary. Maybe you can clarify this on 12.4.3A, where it says that the date that the copy of the written plan was presented to the governing body. Is this the clerk presenting to the Board of County Commissioners, or is this a special district presenting to their Board of Directors? To my knowledge, we haven't been required to do that in the past.
This is the copy of the plan to the governing body. If it's a special district or another entity that submits the plan to their governing body to call the election.
Okay, great.
Do we need to clarify that?
Yeah.
Because it's its own section. I mean, you've got 12.4 is mail ballot plans. 12.4.2 talks about special districts, and 12.4.3 doesn't say whether it's special districts or county clerk's offices. And it would be nice to have that say special districts if that's the case.
I believe the notion that county clerks have to have approval from their board on their mail ballot plan is going to draw some fire. I'm going to jump to 12.4.5. I will tell you, I appreciate your revised draft that came out on November 2nd did include the process for modification of the plans. And that satisfied a lot of the questions and comments we got about this section. So because it required 120 days out, there was a lot of concern that a lot of things can change. And the opportunity now to change, I believe up to 30 days prior to the election, you can submit modifications to that plan for approval. It's a good thing. I don't know if we haven't heard back from any of the clerks since the November 2nd revision, but I'm sure there will be a question that says if a change is mandated after that 30-day period, what do we do? Is there an opportunity to revise that? Wouldn't it be better to offer the county the opportunity to revise the plan so that that plan is amended in a public matter rather than just not letting you guys know we changed the plan? That seems to be the alternative.
Okay.
I mean, it's a good idea to say that you can't change your plan within 30 days, but sometimes circumstances dictate otherwise. 12.4.5, paragraph B. There was a question about this not being required by statute, and that is the. Oh, I'm sorry, Deke. I'm just. That's exactly the same comments you had on three.
I think that this section deals with the primary mail ballot plan, so we may not need this provision here.
It's the same. It's the same verbiage as what Teague was questioning in 12.4.3. Yeah, date that a copy of the written plan was presented to the governing body. Or yeah, that's right. It's primary election, so it wouldn't be a special district.
We'll strike that paragraph.
Yeah, your revised draft did answer a lot of these. Rule 12.4.6. I'm assuming this will take place prior. The intention is to have this in place by the primary 2010, correct? These rules will be in effect for that. So there were a lot of questions, there was confusion about how this worked. So I think, again, I would appeal to the secretary and staff to get with the counties and make sure there's clarity and some understanding about what this is all about. For example, in the statute 17.5, 107, paragraph 2.3, paragraph A, says not less than 30 days nor more than 45 days before a mail ballot primary election, the clerk and recorder shall mail notice by forwardable mail to each inactive, each unaffiliated active, unaffiliated active voter, and to each unaffiliated inactive failed to vote, while 1-7.5, 107, 2.3D says this may be included in other mailing. I guess the point really is just, again, the confusion. There seems to be some overlap. Sure.
You know, please. One suggestion might be, tell us we have to send an information mailing, and to each type of voter, what kind of information needs to be included. That would make it very simple, and everybody would be, perhaps that's a statutory change with the information mailer going out before the general and the primary, which really, if you're trying to give the voter assistance as to how they are going to be able to cast their vote for the primary and general in an even year, you're going to want to send that out prior to the primary. And so if there's, this is the mailer, here's the checklist, if you're mailing to unaffiliated voters, you have to include this portion that's returnable, has this information. That would be a lot easier than all of these different windows and different mailers, and it's one mailer, it's comprehensive. Chances are they're going to pay more attention to a thicker piece of, you know, thicker document coming from the county clerk's office than a postcard here and a mailer there and a letter here.
The overarching comment we received was this has become overly complex and is in dire need of simplification. I think, echoing what Teague said, we're again, creating additional subcategories and going into the mail ballot for the primary, it's created other categories and special circumstances when different mailings go out to who. And it's, you know, in time, I'm sure the county clerks will get it down pat. First time out, though, it invites confusion.
12.4.6A, just a very minor change in language. The way it states now, it's talking about mailing sent to unaffiliated voters prior to a primary, saying that they must affiliate if they want to vote. I think the language says, indicating they have the ability to and must affiliate with a political party in order to vote in a primary election. That's not entirely accurate. They can still vote in the primary election. It's just if they want to vote for a partisan candidate. So we just suggest to add the language in order to vote for a partisan candidate in a primary election. That would avoid some phone calls. I would go on to 12.6.3. This is just a general philosophical question, I guess. It says service centers shall be required in a primary election, basically. And it's basically restating the law. And what we have a hard time doing is, reading between statute and rule and reading those two together. And it makes it more confusing, I think, when we sometimes include a statutory provision in rule in some cases, but not in others. So I'm not sure why that should ever be there. In other words, I think we should be disciplined when writing these rules, that if it's in statute, it's in statute. It doesn't need to be addressed in rule. Rules are for stuff that's not in statute. And so it would help us if we could be disciplined when writing these rules.
And Mike, again, where were you referring? Which?
12.6.3.
Okay, thank you.
In other words, there's really no need for that.
Now, 12.8.1, there was a comment. The new proposed rule states that the marked return envelope does not contain proper identification, the ballot shall be treated as a provisional ballot. The outside of the return envelope shall be marked provisional. I jumping in. I think this is for ID non-compliant voters. The ballot shall be verified and counted as follows. And there was an exception to the use of the word counted as follows. It seems to imply that the ballot will be counted. That may not be the case. The suggestion is to add 12.8.1 paragraph C that states that if the voter does not return proper ID within 8 days, the ballot is not counted. So there is a possibility after that condition that the ballot would not be counted. The implication there is that it will be counted. Page 17. Page 19. There was concern that the way the rule reads as drafted, if the elector whose name does not appear on the poll book states that he or she applied to register to vote prior to the close of registration with the voter registration drive, the election judge shall, and then it goes on to say, it essentially eliminates the purpose of the VRD application receipt. Because it allows for the verification and counting of a provisional ballot when a registrant comes from a, or is claiming to have registered at a VRD, but does not have the VRD receipt. And is that the Secretary of State's intent? And if that is your intent, will that be followed by revising the VRD form to eliminate the receipt to avoid confusion?
I think a couple of years ago in statute, there was a change to the emergency registration statutes, and I think we changed the provisional ballot affidavit to accommodate this because the VRDs can use the national mail registration form. Mm-hmm. They do not have to use our state form. We had to accommodate that process because if they use the national mail registration form, there is no receipt. And so under the emergency registration law, and I think correspondingly on the current provisional ballot affidavit, there is a place for the voter to affirm, and I think right now the judges do that notation, that they attempted to register. So I think really we were just trying to sync this up with what the process
understood.
Is.
Understood. And by allowing the use of the national voter registration form, does that essentially negate the purpose of the receipt on the VRD registration? When the VRD registration came into place, the idea was we're going to have a receipt on there, so the voter has to show that to be allowed to prove that they attempted to vote at the VRD, suspicion being that the VRD didn't turn in the forms. This rule says that the voter does not have to have the receipt from the VRD form to successfully vote by provisional ballot. Has that, in essence, eliminated the need for the receipt?
I think this problem is not new. I mean, I think the statute and the rules have tried to use the Colorado receipt as the protection for the voter that, in fact, they registered at a VRD. But we did get, some time ago, I think a couple of years ago, pushback from the EAC that we simply couldn't do that. Now, your argument is, well, you could not,
right,
because of the national form. Maybe we should just eliminate the receipt. But I'm not sure that it really serves the intended purpose.
And I think that where this came from, Mr. Hobbs, was not a point of aha, we got you. That's not the point. It's when you're conducting judges training and you're talking to judges and completing a provisional ballot, you tell them they have to have a receipt, They don't have to have a receipt. This is what a receipt looks like. If they present a receipt, it does create confusion, not so much for the voter, but for the election judge. And you may end up creating a situation that you're trying to avoid where the judge has got it in their head, like an election administrator with a memory, worst thing possible, is that we require that receipt. And you may have a case where if they don't have the receipt, they're not going to be allowed a provisional ballot. I know that's strictly hypothetical, but it's let's simplify it. Let's get rid of the receipt.
And maybe it's time to do that. I think that is something that I've wondered about for some time, in that we've, I think, retained it, given that it's still the better proof. If someone is going to challenge the voter, the receipt is proof. The allegation, the ability simply to say, well, I think I registered at a VRD at this place,
right,
is a little more amorphous, and maybe the receipt is still better. But it's really, in practice, it's a little hard.
Required. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. You fixed it. Good job. Love the revised draft. Uh, 26.4.3. That's on page 20, I believe. The new rule, when verifying provisional ballots, the designated election official must check the state of Colorado's statewide voter registration database to determine whether the elector has already voted in the election. The question came in, how does this rule ensure that counties not using electronic poll books have had sufficient time to update voter history in order to determine whether a voter has also voted in that county? I don't know that we've ever solved that. I think that problem exists today.
I think you're right.
Living in a county that, or dealing with a county that does vote centers, I mean, it's academic. We update real time. But how do you do it if someone's using paper poll books?
I think you're right. I think that there is an issue there that we just haven't solved yet, and I think that there will be that issue to the extent that we continue to use paper mm-hmm. poll books. I think the intent here really is a good faith effort that you attempt to the extent that the vote credit is in the database, and then to the extent it's not, then we have the backup that we do run the a search to see if anybody has attempted to vote twice.
Right.
So, I mean, we attempt to try to stop that ahead of time, but.
And I hate to bring the question up if the result is requiring counties 72 hours to update their voter history, because there goes my popularity. County clerks. Yeah.
That's
it. The plate's sinking in right now. Rule 26.4.5 on page 20. Again, this is dealing with cancellations and merges. A lot of comments back on that, a lot of questions. And it just, the bottom line is, if we could take another run at it and for clarification, and I'm afraid I don't have recommended verbiage, but maybe by the Thursday extension we'll come up with something. This one did leave some of us scratching our heads what exactly it meant. I skipped 26.4.8. I want to go back to that, but let me hit this 26.5.1. We changed registered to eligible. In the verification of provisional ballots. Change it from the information contained in the provisional ballot envelope and affidavit provides adequate criteria so the designated election official is able to confirm under Election Rule 26 that the elector is, we've crossed out registered and entered eligible. The provisional ballot shall count. Can you just offer me why that was done?
Well, I think.
Sorry, go ahead.
In some cases, you know, we talked about the VRD, the agency, and the receipt. In those cases, the voter would not have been
registered.
But they're eligible to be based upon the law.
All right, that's clear. This is, again, a throwback to an election administrator with a memory. I remember the days when you had eligible voters who were over 18, a resident of the jurisdiction, but weren't registered in a special district. It's like, that's all we've lowered the standard, but you're right, for VRD registrants. They're not. So as Emily Littell has said, never mind. 26.4.8, this was in the revised draft, paragraph B, page 21. If the elector does not provide a date in the previous, and this is trying to get at what races are counted for a provisional voter that has moved within the state. If the elector does not provide a date in the previous residence information section stating when the elector moved to the new legal residence address, the designated election official shall attempt to verify the provisional ballot. If the provisional ballot can be verified, it shall be counted. If it cannot be verified, it shall not be counted. I got to tell you, I read this probably three times, and I don't know what it's saying. It sounds like if the voter did not provide the date of the move, are you directing the clerk to attempt to verify that date? The verbiage is to attempt to verify the provisional ballot. That's what we're doing. That's we're in this process of attempting to verify the provisional ballot. So you're already in mid-process. Mm-hmm. If that date doesn't exist, is the intent of this rule to compel the clerk to verify the date? Maybe that's just that verbiage change. Instead of verifying the provisional ballot, they're trying to verify and maybe suggest how that's done. Yeah. Contact the voter and verify that move date. Is that what's the intent of this rule?
I think that Part B was some of the original language of the rule that was relocated, and I think that it needs a little bit of attention.
Is what I'm asking make sense?
I mean, yes.
It says, you know,
it doesn't seem to say anything.
It doesn't seem to say anything, right?
Tells you to do what you're doing.
Well, and I can't figure out the converse, too. So if it is there, it means we don't have to verify it. Yeah, you know, the ballot. That's,
we'll take a look at that.
Trying, yeah. Missing anything? There was a question in from about 30.1.6 recognized tribes. Will the Secretary of State be supplying clerks with a list of the recognized tribes?
I don't know. We'll look at that.
You know, we were sent here to bring back answers, you know. The rest was training. Was that something? Anything there?
30.11.3. I understand that this may be in response to legislation, but I wanted to just make a general comment and maybe ask a question or two. It's very difficult to train poll workers, as we all know. The reason for that is you spend three-quarters of your time saying, well, here's how you do it, except, 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 except. It's all exceptions. And that's where they screw up. They screw up the exceptions because it's very, very difficult. In 30.11.3, we're adding more exceptions. We've now been asked to find a list of healthcare facilities or what resident of a group residential facility. I don't know where we get that list to begin with. Who provides that list? How we come up with it? We're supposed to provide that in the poll book. Yet another procedure for our poll workers to do, and then have them work from this list. If you have ID. Yeah, you can vote, but if you don't have ID, you got to provide a letter, blah, blah, blah. I mean, it's very complex. That training right there alone, I guarantee you, is going to provide a whole slew of issues on Election Day next year. And I guess what I'm kind of curious about is, to me, when I look at that, that's a provisional ballot. Why are people so scared of provisional ballots? That's the point of provisional ballots. Proper use of provisional ballots takes care of this issue, and we avoid the problem of trying to train and most likely failing to train people to do that procedure properly. And I'm also curious, was there specific legislation that was a particular bill that was in response to? Was that 1336?
It was in legislation. I don't remember what bill it was, but
because if I remember correctly, I can't remember for sure, but I understand that there are certain exemptions for seniors, but you can be a member of a group residential facility and not be a senior. And so thus, are we in line with the statutes? That, and I haven't had time to research.
Yeah, we'll double check. I know this was something that was a struggle during the legislation, during when the legislation was being considered. Hillary?
In House Bill 1336 did enact an amendment to Section 11104, and it's paragraph 19.5B, which says that verification that an individual is a resident of a group residential facility is considered sufficient identification for the purposes of voting under 17110. So essentially what that amendment did is said that a person who's a verified resident of a group residential facility does not need to provide identification at the polls if they're identified as a resident of the facility. So our purpose here is to adopt a rule that tells you how to do that. So if you have recommendations, we'd really appreciate hearing those.
Rule 40 concerning certification of election administrators, designated election officials. We had several comments and suggestions there, and you've got them in writing. I don't need to go over those, but I would request that the Secretary of State and staff consult with the advisory board on certification on some of these. I think they've got some good ideas on how to achieve some of the training outside of the more traditional ways that we've done to date. So, again, just as a suggestion. Are you there?
No. Okay. Regarding training, and I'm not sure if the amended rules address these or not. And I suspect there might be some people in your audience that might have comments about these too. But it seems to me that 44.2.5, requiring a VRD organizer to pass a test with a 100% passage rate to score a perfect score, is a little unreasonable. And I'm not sure if that was the intent. You know, I'm not sure what the intent is there, but I just don't see that as being reasonable unless I'm reading that incorrectly. It seems to me that could be interpreted by some people as us trying to keep them. And I certainly, from Denver's perspective, we don't want to have that. I want to go on record as saying that I think that's unreasonable. Can I ask that question then? I mean, what was the intent?
I don't recall, although it's online training, I think the person can get 100%, and I think that's the idea. I've taken security training, for example, where you don't get cleared until you pass 100%. You can keep trying, but I'm not actually sure, Mike, and so we'll take a look at that. It's not. In other words, I don't think it's intended to be an obstacle at all. But
you can see where some people might interpret it that way.
Yeah.
Also, I noticed 40.5.4 now requiring a training assessment done to poll worker or to actually election workers, and apparently you're going to be implementing some sort of testing and requiring a passage rate of 85%. I don't know what the feedback was statewide, but I would think that when people truly read that, realize the ramifications. I don't know that that's a reasonable requirement either.
Okay.
Most of these people come to the training and are very dedicated to wanting to learn. the biggest problem we have with training right now is the inability to get it, the inability that there's not enough classes offered. And it takes more than 2 years, violation of statute, to get that training. So I would encourage you guys to, and I know we're working on beefing up that training, doing more online, and I think that really needs to take place. I think that's all I have.
Now, it would seem to me, obviously, our goal would be to have them understand the subject matter 100%. So if there's a potential for maybe they're required to score an 85% or better, and if they don't, then there would be a personal 5-10 minute review session with the instructor to clarify the questions that weren't answered correctly. That might be a nice compromise.
I believe that concludes our comments.
No.
Rule 51.
Yes.
I understand the point of Rule 51, and it's basically the way we're operating now. The fact that it's in rule now makes me wonder whether or not what the criteria is that the Secretary of State's office will be using for approving correspondence or not. Seems to be rather subjective at this point, at least in rule. So some clarifying information about what is required for every type of correspondence, I think would be very helpful. I don't want to have my staff or myself writing correspondence only to be rejected and have doing this play back and forth when we're up against deadlines. In addition, I'm curious as to whether or not Spanish, if, for instance, in Denver and seven other counties, we have to use Spanish letters. Is that subject to approval by the Secretary of State's office?
I don't know the answer necessarily, although I'm assuming right now you're doing your own translations.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes.
So we'll take a look at that.
I would just like to piggyback on that with Rule 51, that notion of considering the centralized printing and postage mailing. I think we may be able to accomplish a couple of different goals with that, keeping the correspondence to voters consistent with approved forms.
Okay.
That's it. That's it for our comments. I apologize for, I believe the term was not being organized and polished, but you deserved it, releasing these in October. Hopefully next year we won't see another 35 pages of draft rules in October prior to the general election. In fact, I'd like to hear that guarantee right now. That doesn't occur. But thank you. Appreciate your
thank
patience.
Thank you. Really, I do appreciate all of the work that the clerks did and for your coming here today and providing the input that you did. I know it was difficult under the circumstances, and this is really very valuable. So thank you. Were there any other questions? Okay. Next on the sign-up sheet, Kristen Thompson.
Hi, my name is Kristen Thompson. I am representing the Vote by Mail Project, which is a nonprofit organization that works to advance the use of mail ballots. We participated in the passage of House Bill 1015, and I also need to mention that this testimony was done in conjunction with Common Cause and submitted for both of us. My comments are actually going to be really specific to mail balloting. And with that, how inactive status interacts, but those are pretty much what my comments are too. And since you have a written copy, I'm going to go sort of through what we think are the most important parts. One, I want to echo what the clerk stated about there being confusion and around the many categories for NCOA and that causing not just confusion for the clerks, but confusion for the voters. I think it's important to point out when we talk about inactive voters that we look at the numbers who actually voted of inactive voters who voted in the 2008 election. And these are preliminary numbers, but according to an analysis done with a group that we're allied with, it looks as though there's about 2% of the votes cast in the, it says 2009 election, but it is 2009 election. Oh, this was just this one. Okay, in the 2009 election, were inactive voters. That's almost 13,000 votes. That's not an insignificant number of people. With that in mind, we are concerned about Rule 12.4.5D, 12.4.6, these new categories and what they get mailed. When House Bill 1015 was going through the process this year, this was actually a very hotly contested issue, and there were a number of people in this room that probably remember that. And I think that we can easily say that it was the legislative intent to make sure that people who are inactive, failed to vote voters get mailed both the mailing and the ballot. And so our suggestions here are that with this, the creation of this new category, that these voters are not going to get that special protection that was intended by the legislature during those negotiations and during the passage of that legislation. Our recommendation is, and actually we obviously heard the discussion that was going on here, we would like to be part of that coalition or that group that's put together to really look at the inactive voter status and who gets mailed to what. Our recommendation is that people are mailed both, that NCOA, folks that are on this NCOA list as inactive, that they are mailed both the mailing and the ballot, and that ballot goes to the new address. But again, we really would prefer to participate in a greater discussion around these various status and inactive status and how those folks are mailed. I do want to make this point, at least from the Vote by Mail Project's perspective, notification from a third party should not be enough to make it very difficult for a voter to vote. And that's what we feel this is. This is a third party notification that somebody has moved. Didn't come from the clerk, didn't come from the voter. So I guess if there are any questions about that, about that section.
Thank you.
I think we have talked about it a lot in here. Rule 12.3.4B, this is around public comment from the clerk that a election is going to be conducted by mail. We hope that the comment period is extended to the public for 10 business days. We actually feel that the rule that was created around notice of vote center elections is good, and probably that rule should be followed exactly for the notice of mail ballot elections, the 15-day window, 10-day comment. And we believe that they should be both through testimony and through written comment. And that was a question that came up earlier. Any questions on that one? Oh, actually, I've got something else to include there. I'm wondering if it's possible for a time window of when these plans are going to come out or when we should be watching for that notice, that public notice of the fact that there's going to be a public comment period. If there's some time frame that we should be looking on the clerk's website, or is it going to be posted on the Secretary of State's website? But that those of us who watch elections have that opportunity to, that we're not checking every single day of the year. That's definitely not going to happen. moving on to Rule 12.4, these are the mail ballot plans. We actually were really pleased about how comprehensive the proposed rules were, and we felt that in looking at what other states require in those plans, that there were some pretty there were some gaps. So here's what we're suggesting, and I'm just going to run through them since you've got them on paper. We'll submit written comments as well. Whether or not that mailing is going to be conducted in-house or whether it's going to be sent to a vendor, again, a third party who's playing a pretty major role in the administration of the election. What type of voting system is going to be used, and the ballot format that is going to be utilized. The process for counting ballots, the timeline, and the personnel plan. Is the plan going to be conducted by volunteers, or is it going to be paid staff, or a combination of both? The timeline for when lists get pulled, and the plan for lists get pulled for the original mailing, and the plan for tracking and sorting those changes at changes that happen after that poll, as well as a plan for duplicate ballots. We're looking for details on the date the original mailing is going to be created and the process for automatically sending ballots to the voters who changed their address or registered to vote, for that matter, after the original mailing was sent and created before the voter registration deadline. And I actually have personal experience with that in this last election. I moved in September and got everything in on time and did not receive a ballot. It probably bounced back and had to go actually through quite a number of steps to get a ballot. And the joke was, don't you think they ought to keep a list of people who you don't mess up sitting next to the phone of the people who are taking the calls? I was actually informed that I had to come down and fill out a form in order to receive my ballot, which wasn't true. So I think that having that plan in place and acknowledging that there are time periods that happen between when the list gets pulled, that we need to know what that process is. The plan for transferring returned ballot envelopes to other counties, this has got to happen. If it's an all-mail ballot election, I'm sure that stuff happens in Jefferson County or Denver, and what the plan is for exchanging those ballots. The plan for signature verification in accordance with the rules. The plan for picking up voted ballots and the available methods for dropping off ballots. Is it walk-in only? Is there plenty of parking? Is it available drive-through? Some of that obviously will be in flux, but it would be nice to know what if there's going to be a plan, especially for drive-through drop-off. Questions on those? So we actually also felt that there were some rules that some issues from 10-15 that really needed to be addressed greater in rule. And I should say that on the next point, what is required for the mail ballot plans may actually be taken care of in this next piece. There is a statute 1-7.5-105 that requires a Secretary of State to produce a manual or a standard plan for conducting elections by mail. There's actually the state of Oregon has one that is very comprehensive and very good, and we actually cited that. That really provides an opportunity for standardization and can include exactly what the clerks were talking about, who gets mailed what when. And we think that that actually could really solve a lot of the problems that we have been talking about here. And again, it does provide that opportunity for standardization. We'd like to see that get created, and again, would like to participate in perhaps helping create that. I'm not sure one actually currently exists out there. That there is some plan for coordination, some rule around coordination with the U.S. Postal Service. And again, this is probably easily addressed in the best practices manual, but that is a really critical component of all mail ballot elections, is ensuring that those ballots are going out in coordination with the Postal Service, and they understand that this is going to happen. Inactive status. Elections, since we've talked ad nauseum about that, I'll leave that. And that the folks that are involved in the counting of mail ballots, that there's some rule about who they can be and can't be, and we're actually suggesting that they can't be relatives, and it's got a statutory definition there, or a definition of relative of the candidate on the ballot at a particular election. Obviously, probably not a problem in urban areas, but in small rural counties, I would say that it would be necessary for that to be stated. I think that this is particularly important as we extended in 10-15, I think it was, or in some other legislation this year, the amount of time that a count can happen from 10 days to 15 days. So, having that information out there, we think there probably needs to be some restriction around who's privy to that, particularly if the county's doing a hand count. There aren't currently rules around voting in person in a mail ballot election, particularly when it comes to surrendering a ballot. We suggest that actually, and these are taken pretty much around the language in rule about surrendering a mail-in ballot, and so we just modified those, and those are there for you. We also wanted to state, even though it is in statute, that unaffiliated voters are not giving up their right to vote in this election, so we would like to see rule about they do have the opportunity to walk in, affiliate, and vote on the machine, even in a mail ballot election. And that is all I have. I actually want to make a statement about cost, because it always comes up. But I think it's important to remember that while we consider what additional mailings cost, it's also important to consider what is being saved by moving to an all-mail ballot election. That was a stated intent from the clerks and counties about why they wanted to conduct primaries by mail. So that while we're focusing on cost, that we're also looking at what is being saved and what that balance is. Thank you.
Any questions for Ms. Thompson? Thank you. You know, one thing that occurs to me to mention, because of things, you know, you referred to best practices, and you referred to wanting to be involved in subsequent processes to flesh out some of this, and the clerk said the same thing. We do have still in place Rule 50, which is intended to establish a best practices and vision commission. And we're well behind where we wanted to be, but we are going to do that. And I think that may be a process by which a lot of these things will be addressed in a public way, where people can, in a more informal way than rulemaking, where we can flesh out these details and get people to put their heads together and help us figure out what are the best practices and how do we flesh out the details and how should these things work. So I do want everyone to know that's still going to happen. So.
And actually, I would say, I think that is actually the better place, instead of in rulemaking where we all are reacting.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you. Jenny Flanagan.
Good afternoon. Jenny Flanagan with Colorado Common Cause. I think first I'll just point to a couple other things in the testimony that Kristen provided in those comments. First, going back to the treatment of inactive NCOA in and out of county, I think our point here when we're talking about these primary vote-by-mail and vote-by-mail elections is, at minimum, we want these voters to get notice of the election. And when we sort of shift this into this new category of NCOA and we have that forwarding address, we know that that information that goes to the voter about a notice of election really helps drive that turnout. And especially in a mail ballot election, that voter could respond and say, well, yes, mail the ballot here. Or, you know, I mean, sort of gives that voter an opportunity, again, to confirm their new address and get that ballot sent to the correct address. Yes, we would like to see the mail ballots go there, but we understand that's a more complicated conversation, and certainly working with the County Clerks Association and other election administrators will be required, I think, before we find that magic solution. And like Kristen said, I think we all just want to be part of that conversation. The other thing on our last page, we just sort of want to mention that we really support adding tribal identification, that clarification. We're also part of that Colorado Lawyers Committee Task Force, and I know we've been working hard to address that for a number of years, not just this year, both legislatively and through rules. I mean, we think this is a really appropriate and necessary change. In terms of the training, the clerk's training, I think, you know, that's been a good move. Well, I'd like to hear more from the clerks themselves in terms of whether or not it's been a beneficial training. One thing we noticed is that we took the SCORE functional training, which is sort of the what seemed like one of the more comprehensive components of the training, and we put it into an elective rather than as one of the core curriculums, and that just sort of struck us as out of place, I guess. It seems like such a critical function to the administration of our elections, how we interface with this database, that it really should, it seems core. So I'm not sure why that was moved, but that was just something that we noticed as we were reviewing the rules. Some of the other things that came up in previous testimony that I just want to touch on the voter registration drive exam, I do agree that 100% does seem burdensome. I think Faith Gross, who and some of the other voter registration drive organizations that we've talked to, you do have an opportunity to go back and take the test again. But I think looking at that, making sure it's not an intimidating barrier is an important critique. I mean, I think broadly in terms of the conversations, when we talk about what how to deal with active, inactive, and these other changes, you know, the ultimate fail-safe, and I know the legislature will probably have to address this, but the ultimate fail-safe is for Colorado to move to an election day registration format. And I think if we do all the things we're talking about and we take all the necessary steps to get folks onto the rolls, to maintain our lists and do all that, then election day registration really does become a fail-safe rather than a burden, and would address a lot of the concerns. Now, I actually do have a more formal testimony that I'd like to present. And the testimony I'd like to present is on behalf of Colorado Common Cause, Mi Familia Vota, and the Service Employees International Union. And our groups have engaged in a number of projects and programs together and individually to increase electoral participation, and certainly including engaging in litigation with this office around the what we thought were illegal purges of voters from the registration list. And some of the issues involved in the lawsuit are related to some of these proposed rules. I think generally speaking, we think there are a lot of great improvements in the rules here today, and we thank the Secretary's office for their work. Our comments here focus on improving the regulations specifically around the adequacy of notice to voters and sufficiencies for opportunities to correct those errors, and then access to information about the elections. So first on Rule 2.18.2, while this rule is an improvement, we think it can go further and specifically give the voter the opportunity to confirm where she or he lives and an explanation of the impact of the failure to do so. And our recommendation of the most effective method to do this has three components. One, asking the voter to confirm her address of record if she presents herself to vote at the precinct. Two, modifying the confirmation card to make clear the impact of the voter, that they'll continue to remain registered unless they confirm this change to the NCOA indicated address, and then three, sending that confirmation card by forwardable mail. Obviously, as technology advances and legislation catches up to technology, there may be new ways that we provide notice in the future, but I think given our current framework, we think this is sort of the best practice and the best approach, and you'll see that I've submitted some specific language that can be reviewed. I don't know that I need to delve into it. The second comment is on Rule 2.19.2, and this is regarding the testing and design of the confirmation card, and we really support this usability and kind of testing to maximize sort of the voters' ability to use it and minimize confusion. And we recommend that the testing include methods to maximize access to voters who are older, disabled, or have limited English proficiency. And we caution that we have to strike a balance between taking advantage of this testing, but not let it sort of thwart our ability to move forward. That there are examples out there around the country where we have seen really the ability to work with usability experts and move these things forward pretty swiftly, so we can really take advantage of some of those benefits. On Rule 2.20, this is where, again, we've talked about going into the details of this inactive NCOA status. And, you know, we generally support the creation of these designations and the accompanying changes to 218.3 that allows the county clerks to only cancel inactive voters with the NCOA out of county status, and then therefore keeping those inactive in-county folks to stay registered. And I think, as Teek Simonton said, I thought pretty well, and I know she just left the room, but it is a confusing process. And to the extent we can keep voters on the list who are interested in engaging in our elections, that's certainly our goal. We're concerned and oppose the provisions of Rule 220.2, where these voters no longer get notice of the election. And there's sort of three arguments to make here. First, we think it conflicts with existing law. Section 152061A talks about notice to inactive voters and says that the only reasons why we wouldn't send them is if mailings were returned as undeliverable, that the statute really doesn't create an exception for inactive voters whose addresses are put into doubt because of this NCOA data. So in our opinion, the law clearly requires that electors in inactive NCOA status should still receive these notices. The rule creates an exception that we don't believe is found in statute. So we urge the Secretary to follow the clear intention of the existing statute that all inactive voters receive notice of the elections, except in circumstances where there is proof that the notice will not be received by that voter, because we know that address is wrong. And I know we've made this argument time and again. We believe it is good public policy to get notices in the hands of voters. We believe that these are the most effective ways to inform and educate the voting public. And I know we're sort of in this paradoxical position where, on the one hand, we're looking at NCOA data, but the Secretary sort of made the policy decision that the data is not reliable enough to update that record and take that position, but at the same time taking the position that the fact that we have that information should prohibit somebody from getting notice of the election. So we are using that data for some reasons, but not all. So again, we just encourage a state to really look at the importance of notices and in terms of keeping the voter informed of elections as they come up. Finally, election notices sent to inactors are sent by non-forwardable mail, so we think that sort of has that protection. Whereas I was talking earlier about, I know it's a little bit confusing, the vote-by-mail elections, and it gives an opportunity for the voter to correct that address and participate in a vote-by-mail election. Here in a polling place election, I think one of the concerns is you don't want to send that voter the wrong precinct information. So by sending it to the not by non-forwardable mail, they wouldn't be getting at their new address old precinct information. That makes sense. I know it's, I think we laid it out more clearly in the writing if I didn't clearly express it now. I think those are the main points that I wanted to pull out. You do have our written testimony. I will also suggest, and I don't know if this is a plan for the office, I know when we've done rulemakings recently on the voting systems, the Secretary's office was able to post all of the written testimonies on their website. I thought that was a really helpful way for the voting public to really engage in the process. Certainly we, at the, you know, we'll send in our comments electronically, but really encourage this office to post the comments publicly so those who are listening online will have an opportunity to get the benefit of the written testimony.
And thank you, and that is our intent, to post all written comments.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. Any questions for Ms. Flanagan? Monica? Marquez.
This is Monica from the Attorney General's Office. I would just be curious if the county clerks who previously testified have any comments about the proposed alternate language submitted by Common Cause for 2.18.2 B and C, either now or perhaps by the deadline.
And again, I would have, of my comments, I have not had the opportunity to share that with everyone yet.
Absolutely, and I want your comments with, you know, if you have comments to their written comments, that would be helpful as well.
And I haven't seen their written comments, just what we heard today. So I think, again, I think it would really provide greater depth to our discussion. And I know, certainly for me, I wasn't prepared to send them last week or anything, but mm-hmm. I think that once they get posted, we can be responsive to some of the other recommendations that were put forward.
I think that would be very helpful. Thank you.
So it sounds like we can get that scan and put up today. So,
oh, terrific.
And I would echo that. I think it would be helpful for Jenny, for you to comment on what the clerks, if you have any major comments, to let us know that, you know, in the additional comment period, and vice versa, as Ms. Marquez was saying, that if the clerks would look at the suggestions that Jenny Flanagan has provided here and provide some input there as well, that would be very valuable. So, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Faith Gross.
Thank you. Faith Gross, representing the Legal Center for People with Disabilities and Older People. I'm the authorized representative of the disability community on election-related accessibility issues. And I need to apologize to Mr. Scarpello. I found it necessary to go out and put money in my meter, so I didn't get a $25 ticket, and so I missed the most of his comments on Rule 30.11.3. That's where I want to start my comments, and that's the rule regarding polling place ID requirement exemption for residents of residential group facilities. The proposed rule as written is acceptable. It does place the burden of identifying all of the county's group residential facilities onto each county clerk's election staffs. However, I understand that this should be that first of all, this is not a new requirement, that this was required previously for purposes of mail ballot delivery, and that the change in Colorado Revised Statutes 1-1-104, paragraph 18.5, actually clarifies what is a group residential facility for election purposes. So hopefully that clarification in statute will make this obligation a little bit easier. I also recognize that this is more burdensome for large population counties such as Denver, the metro counties. I do think that the new rule will facilitate uniform compliance across the state, and I do regard it as more of a training issue for election staffs and for election judges and poll workers. That's where the rubber meets the road, and that's where this is going to be implemented, and I think training will really need to take care to make sure that everybody understands this. Finally, a final comment. I have found that very few residents of group facilities actually go to a polling place, a precinct polling place, or a vote center to vote. That the in my voter registration work in 2008, where I registered over 200 people who were residents of group facilities, I can only recall one, maybe two, who did not choose to sign up for the permanent mail-in ballot. Regarding Rule 30.1.6GV, or 5, which is the valid identification card adding tribal ID, I am a member of the Colorado Lawyers Committee Election Task Force, and as Mr. Westfall testified, this has been a big issue for us, and I'm really glad to see this added. I'd also like to note for the record that Native American populations have a, according to the U.S. Census, have a significantly higher rate of disability than most other populations. I've seen figures in the 24% to 27%. Of tribal members being people with disabilities, so it's a significant benefit for people with disabilities, and will improve access for historically disenfranchised populations. Last comment is on Rule 44.2, which is the training for voter registration drives. I believe I may be the only voter registration drive organizer in the room today. And as such, I'm okay with the changes that are in the proposed rules. I've noticed that election laws and rules change every year, at least once every year, and certainly after legislative session. And I don't have any reason to think that that won't continue. At least statute will not continue to change for a while. And so I think that requiring annual training instead of training every other year is actually a good idea, so that voter registration drive organizers who have been doing it for several years, like myself, are kept up to date. Adding the online option for training will make it more accessible. However, and I'm pleased to see that there's still the option for accessing the training here in the Secretary of State's office. I do have a question. And will that training in the Secretary of State's office be online as well? It appears to be the intent, the way the rule is written. But I wonder if there would be any opportunity for dialogue with a staff person in the Secretary of State's office, whether you're doing this online or in person here. When I've gone through the training, which I've done twice now, there was that opportunity to get clarification or ask questions. I don't know how that's going to work with an online training session.
Okay.
And then I would just mention, I would like to comment, it's not in my written comments, which I'll give you in a minute, but the 100% correct requirement was not something that I knew about this year when I took my 10-question test online. However, I missed at least one question. That was because I didn't look in the rules or in statute when I was taking the test. I thought I knew it all, and obviously I didn't. So I did, when I got the message from the Secretary of State's office saying that I had not passed 100% correct, I was told at that point that I had two more tries to get them all right. And believe me, I pulled out all of the information that I had received in the training, and all the answers were there. It's an open book test, and I would, maybe you want to put language on the website that says, we recommend that you refer to the training materials when you take this test. And I would think if you did that, everybody should be able to get 100%. I did get 100% the second time I took the test, and I've talked to some of my colleagues who are also voter registration drive organizers and who have been doing this for a few years, and I was not the only one who did not get 100% the first time, but we all got 100%. Those are my comments, and I do have a written copy for you.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions for Ms. Gross? Thank you very much, Faith. Ryan Call.
Thank you, Mr. Hobbs, members of the committee. It's a pleasure for me to be here. The name is Ryan Call from the law firm of Hale Friesen, here on testifying on behalf of the Colorado Republican Party, for whom I serve as legal counsel. I'll try to keep my comments brief and pointed to specific provisions of the rules that the party would like to sort of weigh in on with respect to the proposed draft. Obviously, we would like to reserve the opportunities to submit later written comment and responses to comments received from other individuals as well to help weigh in on this process. I'd like to compliment, to begin with, the members of the Secretary of State's staff for dealing with a lot of complicated issues and such. First off, a lot has been discussed with respect to the inactive NCOA in and out of county comments with respect to proposed Rule 2.18. Party and on behalf of the party would reiterate that we would have some significant reservations if ballots, live ballots, were going out to any individual who's been identified as inactive. And so the rules as they're drafted presently we're in support of with respect to dealing with that. We do have, moving forward, a couple of other observations. Expressing some concerns with respect to the implementation of 2.22. and 2.23. This is on page 5 of the proposed rules. Certainly understand that much of the impetus for implementing Rule 2.22 is as a result of the litigation involving Common Cause that was filed shortly before the election. I am concerned, and the party has some significant concerns with respect to how that might impact Secretary of State and the many clerks. By moving to a statewide voter registration database, it's designed to help improve the quality of those lists, and we are concerned that if you've got these essentially almost 180 days before a general election, where the clerks are hamstrung in terms of eliminating or merging those duplicates generated from the score system, it could create some real problems with respect to the integrity of those lists, particularly as voters increasingly choose to vote by mail. And in ensuring the safeguards and integrity of the election is of the utmost concern for the party. I am also a little concerned with, or at least unclear, how we reconcile 2.22 and 2.23. 2.23 seems to obviously contemplate that during that time period, 90 days before the primary or the general election, the clerks are entitled to consolidate electors' records where duplicates' records are canceled. And yet 2.22 says the clerks are not allowed to use a list generated from the score database. So I'm looking for some clarification as if they can't use the score generated database list, what list are they using to base on that? And if so, is there opportunity for outside sources and things like that for weighing in? I guess I'm just unclear how, if they're not using the score generated report to then examine those potential duplicate records, what lists are they using? With respect to Rule 12.3.4, and in connection therewith 12.4.4, as it relates to the decision by a clerk and recorder or a county to conduct the primary election by an all-mail ballot, we welcome the opportunity to provide and participate actively in that decision-making process. Like some concerns that were expressed previously, having a better understanding of when that decision needs to be made with adequate time in advance, is that a decision that's made prior to the submission or presentation of a plan? Is there a time window in which that needs to be made by? And also might recommend amending paren A to 12.3.4 to clarify that in addition to providing public notice through the county party website or through publication, that the clerks, county clerks and recorders, should be requested or required to inform the Secretary of State when that opportunity for public comment and determination would be taking place, especially if there is not a very well-defined time window when that decision of when a mail-in ballot is going to be made for a primary election will take place. It would be certainly helpful for the party committees to be able to weigh in. The party committee obviously playing a unique role and having a particularly important interest with respect to when those primary elections will be conducted and the form in which those elections will be conducted. Uh, As it relates to Rule 12.4.4, I assume the clerk's or the Secretary of State's office is aware of a potential typo in paren G, referring to drop-off locations instead of drop-of, and then the two semicolons. Just identify that for your interest. We would like to see the proposals in 12.4.4 in terms of what that written plan needs to include, to also include at least some discussion of how and the proper role of party-appointed poll watchers, challenge procedures, and in particular how the clerk intends on dealing with ballot resolution teams to be a part of that mail-in ballot plan. I know that the party committees have had a lot of excellent conversations. In particular, I'll call out both Douglas County and Denver for being very proactive in working with party representatives when we're talking about mail-in elections or absentee ballots or mail-in ballots to permit the ability of the party to have an active role in recommending, making recommendations to representatives from the party to participate, especially on ballot resolution teams. As part of that, and we'd like to have that to be incorporated as part of that mail-in ballot plan that the county clerks and recorders need to wrestle with. Especially if you're going to an all-mail election, the opportunity for party poll watchers and election challenge procedures is much more restrictive and limited, and knowing at what point in the process can a party poll watcher sort of raise concerns, challenge potential votes or ballots that are being cast by voters who are believed to be ineligible to vote. All those kind of procedures, I think, needs to be part of that mail-in ballot plan wrestled with by the clerks appropriately. We would very much support the recommendation in Rule 12.4.6A for clarification to say that in order for a person to participate and vote in the primary election, it's in reference to a vote for a partisan candidate. I think that was Mr. Scarpello of Denver who made the recommendation to clarify that the participation of being able to vote for a partisan candidate is what would require party affiliation. The party is very, very supportive of the proposed rule, at least in concept, of 12.4.6 that would affirmatively reach out to voters and ensure that they have an opportunity to adequately affiliate with the party and vote in an all-mail ballot. We are concerned that if Rule 12.4.6 were to be modified and simply subsumed by a standard sort of mass information mailing, that particular aspect of kind of flagging to the voter that you need to affiliate with the party in advance of a mail-in ballot primary will get lost in a deluge of information. In our experience, a simple, concise one message, they get a piece of mail that says, if you want to vote in the primary, you have to affiliate, return this form to the clerk so you can affiliate and participate in the upcoming mail-in primary is much preferable to just including it within a mass mailing that could get lost, especially if it's coming quite a bit in advance of the election. So the current rule, which requires the clerks to affirmatively send a specific mail piece that identifies the need to register to vote or affiliate with the party, in order to participate in that anticipated mail-in primary is something the party is very supportive of. While it's not a proposed specific change, it is something that the party we would like to raise to the attention of the Secretary of State, perhaps as an opportunity for helping provide clarity in processing the election. In rule, which is renumbered as 12.5.2, there's reference to the need to include distinctive markings or colors on the different ballots that are being returned. We'd like to suggest that same need to include some distinctive markings or colors has particular importance in the application of Rule 12.5.7. If a voter is being sent a ballot, but that voter's registration is not completed yet, I know that number of counties, Denver in particular, will have a sort of separate type of envelope that flags so that at the very beginning, the election judges, the poll workers can be looking for that voter ID that's included to know whether or not it needs to go in the ID accepted, count that ballot, or be set aside into a provisional flag. If there's an opportunity to look at that, whether it's by rule or in the context of best practices, having something that will identify those voters from the very beginning of that outer envelope being returned to the Elections Division, that this is a ballot that's being returned by a voter who registered to vote by mail initially and has not yet provided that form of ID that's required. Starting that from the very beginning and being able to segregate those ballots so election judges that are adequately trained know what to look for, and party poll watchers that are keeping an eye open for that to make sure that those ballots are being treated appropriately, whether they go into the provisional stack or whether they go into the go ahead and count it stack, is being done appropriately. That in particular has to do with the implementation of Rule 12.8 and 12.8.1, identifying that if it comes back and doesn't have that ID, it needs to be going into that provisional ballot category. Makes sense. We would be very supportive, the party is supportive of clarification to 12.8.1, clarifying that that reference to be verified and counted does not imply that if they have not satisfied the requirements of the statute to provide that ID, then that ballot would not be counted. So some clarifying language there would be helpful and appropriate. In particular, with respect to rules 26.3.1 and 26.3.2, the proposed language is very good, and the party is very supportive to clarify that if a person is not showing up on those poll books, the elector is in fact offered that provisional ballot. I know that in the last election cycle, there was oftentimes some questions or some confusion, whether that's a result of bad training or perhaps not unclear rules, but that anybody who's not showing up on that voter registration or on the poll book should always be offered the provisional ballot and not be permitted to vote a regular ballot until they've gone through that provisional ballot checking. You might want to consider a modification to 26.3.2C to consider rather than an either-or in the draft of the rules, maybe an and-or, so that if all of that information can be included as part of the decision-making or to be included as part of the material that's being collected. As we look at trying to understand how Rule 26.4.2 would be applied with respect to the verification of electors' eligibility to have that provisional ballot counted, our concern of how paren D will be applied in terms of if the universe of information that the clerks are authorized to look at includes information that's included on the provisional ballot envelope and affidavit. Looking at 26.4.2 paren D in connection with Rule 26.4.7B, the question becomes is if the elector did not provide sufficient explanation of the terms under which that person attempted to register to vote through either a VRD or an agency, is it clear in rule in paren B of 26.4.7 that the elector must provide that information at the time of voting? Or does this open the door for a voter to come back after the fact and try to amend or supplement the material that's being described on that provisional ballot envelope? We think if the door is open to allowing voters to come back after the fact and revise or amend what they've described as that affidavit is an invitation for gamesmanship and is problematic. We would recommend strongly that language be amended in paren B of 26.4.7 that indicates that voter is required to provide the required information at the time of voting. If that affidavit is incomplete, if it's not or any other information that is not included as part of that provisional ballot, it would be, I think, an invitation for gamesmanship to allow lots of extra sort of parole evidence to be amended or added writing on that provisional ballot after the fact. So we'd recommend that we either look at how we clarify 26.4.2D or figure out how that provision applies with respect to a 26.4.7B. In the context of where does that sort of window for the voter to provide that information and fill out that affidavit close? Is it at the election or is it opened up till afterwards? And that clarity is something that the party needs to know. Any questions about that before I move on to a couple of other provisions?
Okay.
The party is very supportive of the change to Rule 30.1.6 with respect to the form of ID for a federally recognized tribal government membership. It would be helpful in terms of implementation for the Secretary of State and the clerks to provide examples to both poll watchers and poll workers as to what both the list of which tribes would satisfy this ID requirement, as well as providing some informational materials that will allow poll workers and poll watchers to recognize what those forms of ID look for. I know that oftentimes, obviously, somebody who's participating in the election is very familiar with many of the other forms of ID, but the federally issued tribal ID government membership is something that, while there maybe not be particular standards, at least a representative sample of what we're looking for would be help avoid a lot of issues and potential challenges down the road. Republican Party has some, while we're very supportive of members of the disability community and those that are residents of group residential facilities in exercising their right to vote, are concerned that 30.11.3 is not sufficient to satisfy what the statute is looking for in terms of verification that a person is in fact a resident of that group residential facility. The way that 30.11.3 is currently drafted suggests that a person merely needs to show up and say, I'm Bob Jones, I'm staying at the group residential facility, and that's it, the person's allowed to vote a regular ballot. No actual affirmative verification needs to be actually presented by the voter to the poll worker that is processing that. It appears to me, as you're reading the language in 1104.19.5c, that verification of that a person is a resident of a group facility suggests that they have to bring some sort of verification, some sort of affirmative document saying, I am a resident of, and my name is such and such. And my concern and the party's concern with respect to the way that 30.11.3 is drafted is that if you aren't bringing some sort of affirmative documentation and verification that a person is a resident of the facility, I don't think that satisfies what the statute has outlined as a requirement of verification. The verification as it's drafted currently is simply the voter says, yes, I'm Bob Smith and I live at the group residential facility. I don't think that's what the statute contemplates or is sufficient to meet that test. If the person shows up and all they have is their self-affirmation, I'm Bob Smith and I reside, I think that puts that voter clearly into the provisional ballot category as not having brought that verification document with them. Some sort of a letter, as is contemplated in paren B, from a facility, I think would satisfy that, in which case that was what should be applied in terms of A. But if there is no residence or if there is no affirmative verification that's being brought by that voter, I don't think that satisfies what the statute outlines. As Ms. Gross from the disability community indicated, the burden that's being placed upon members or residents of the group facility seems to be a very, very small one. As she's indicated, of her many years of experience, only one or two people might be impacted by the requirement to go get a letter from the group residential facility attesting that they are a resident of. That does not seem to be an onerous burden, especially if we're requiring every other voter to bring at least a photocopy of their utility bill. I think that we need to make sure that we're treating voters in a consistent manner, while also recognizing a particular community that might be ripe for challenge, recognizing that this community in particular is not likely to show up to the polls. The ability to safeguard somebody showing up and simply getting a list of people that are part of an Alzheimer's ward or any other sort of representatives of group facilities, to just simply have a list of names and someone just showing up and saying, yep, I'm Bob Smith, I live at the residential facility, I get to vote Bob Smith's ballot, is, we think, of significant concern. So while being and making very clear that we're supportive of members of this particular community in terms of their ability to vote, we don't think the rule 30.11.3, as it is presently drafted, satisfies the requirement of the statute to bring some sort of affirmative verification to the polling center to verify eligibility. Moving on to a couple of other provisions that are identified. As it relates to the role of voter registration drive organizers, I also find myself in that small category, along with Ms. Gross's, being a VRD sponsor for the party and various party committees. And I can tell you, some of these provisions give me a little bit of heartburn. I did pass the test with 100%, but only because I was referring to the open notes. While it's not a section involved in the proposed rulemaking that makes modifications, I will say that the implementation of Rule 44.2.2 that requires organizers to keep on file the signed attestations from every circulator that he or she has trained or provided information or materials for is something that I think is beyond what the statutory authority permits, and particularly as it relates to the role of political party committees and party staff and organizers and precinct committee people, recognizing that essentially the entire Republican Party apparatus is using the VRD number of which I am the organizer, gives me a little bit of heartburn, recognizing that, that keeping all that information on file from every party volunteer that wants to go out there and register voters, the implementation of 44.2.2 is invitation for noncompliance, I guess is what I'm saying. And the Secretary should examine whether they are with the statutory authority to require signed attestations from every circulator that is circulating voter registration drive forms or materials pursuant to a VRD sponsor. Looking at the implementation of Rule 51, in particular Rule 51.2, I think that needs to be modified where it indicates that the Secretary of State shall approve standard forms to be used. I think the Secretary should clarify that may be used by political parties and organizations that provide. The rule as it is currently drafted suggests that party committees and organizations are required to use the Secretary of State approved form. Again, as we've been discussing, they aren't. They can use a national mail-in voter registration form or other forms that meet the standards of the statutes. So that should be clarified. In addition, recognizing Rule 51.2, while I know that the rule is intended to suggest and refer to those forms that are actually the official form being provided by the Secretary of State, without some additional clarification to 51.2, it may suggest that the Secretary of State must approve any form that a party, for example, as referenced in 51.2.2, intends in using for mass mailings. We recognize that 51.2.3 opens the door and provides an opportunity for the parties and organizations for them to contact the Secretary of State, to have them review the form if they're doing a mass mailing. But I am concerned that if you read that versus 51.2, it might create some confusion as to, is the Secretary of State required to approve a form that a political party or a campaign committee is going to be sending out to voters? Does it require the affirmative stamp of approval by the Secretary of State in advance, or are those organizations simply permitted and invited to contact the Secretary of State to have them review with that? The concern also is driven home by 51.2.4, where the somewhat vague and disconcerting injunctive action or other penalties is provided as a potential sanction to groups or party committees that may or may not violate Rule 51. Any time in rule that we don't actually spell out what those penalties may include gives at least the party lawyer a little bit of heartburn. That concludes the specific observations or recommendations from the party committee, recognizing that the party committee may, the Republican Party will consider submitting written comments to summarize many of these observations and recommendations, as well as to respond to those draft recommendations provided by the groups, by Common Cause, and by the organizations. Before I conclude, are there any questions or?
Any questions for Mr. Call? Thank you very much. I don't believe I have anyone else signed up to testify, but does anyone want to add to their comments? Hearing none. We'll go ahead and close the hearing. As I said earlier, we'll keep the rulemaking record open until close of business on Thursday. And anyone may provide written comments to the Secretary of State's office and will be made part of the record and will be considered. I would suggest one easy way to do that would be to email your written comments to Andrea Geiger. Her email address is andrea.geiger, G-Y-G-E-R, at sos.state.co.us. So with that, then we'll adjourn. The time is 4:32 p.m. And again, I really appreciate all of the comments, the testimony, and the thought that went into providing us feedback. So thank you very much.